You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
I'm Brad Jackson.
And we've got Norm back.
Hey, guys. Happy to be here, as always.
Starting to be like Cheers in here. Norm!
Yeah. Because that's the first time I've heard that joke. I've never heard that before. That's... Thank you. Thank you for that. Glad I like you guys.
There was a joke?
This week, we need to be a little bit more gentlemanly and suit up for this episode.
Hold on, I'm at the wrong podcast. Wait a second.
Yeah.
Because this week we're going to talk about The Kingsman. And to go along with talking about The Kingsman, what are we smoking this week, Brad?
So this week we are smoking Crowned Heads La Imperosa.
Yeah, there was a crown on the label. We thought it was fitting. Talk about
The Kingsman. Like Kingsman and a crown. Yeah.
We had to go to our cigar tailor to get this handcrafted.
Shout out to the cigar tailor.
But this is going to support a Ecuadorian Habano Oscuro wrapper with Nicaraguan binders and fillers. Kind of off the bat for me, saying medium full. That's what I'm thinking.
At this point, I think we smoke so many like strong cigars that are medium full is like everyone else is like full.
Yeah. I mean, medium full is a fair assessment for La Imperiosa cigar.
Yeah, I mean, with the Habano wrapper, of course, you're going to the spice is probably the most dominating flavor that's coming through at the moment. Which, for me personally, I really enjoy. This kind of reminds me of, one of my other favorite go-tos, the Julius Caesar, in a way. Yeah. So, something about the Habano with the, Nicaraguan binders and fillers, I mean...
You definitely got to hit a pepper up front.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get a bad
more
smoke.
So than, more so than something like the Julius Caesar, where you don't get that big hit of pepper.
I was going to say that this actually has a little bit more complexity to it, I think. I'm getting, some additional flavors and stuff. I know, that's sacrilege, right? I mean, but...
Yes.
I call it like I see it. Of course, not everybody's palate is exactly the same, but this is shaping up to be a wonderful smoke. If I could only get my hands on some Statesman whiskey now, that's probably going to take it next level.
The little backstory in the cigar too. The La Imperiosa is based on originally a Cuban brand from the early 1900s, and they've kind of based the coloring and the band design on the kind of an homage to the original Cuban version, and it comes in like traditional Cuban vitolas, so like the Minutos, the Magicos, the Dukes, stuff that we don't normally see very often. So it's kind of a homage to Cuban cigar history.
Yeah, especially with the cigar industry and their latest trends are for these bigger ring gauge cigars. Crown Heads decided to really stick close to the smaller, the more traditional sizings.
Yeah, and we got the Duke size, which is a 5x54. So
yeah, fair size.
Yeah, it's like you're what you traditionally think of a cigar size instead of like the monsters that we all smoke these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, shameless plug here. So, as we get to talking about the Kingsman and, all the shenanigans that go with getting your suit tailored and everything else, we need to give a shout-out to Strike Force Energy.
Yeah, because if you're going to have to hunt, drug cartel and somewhere in South America, you should call in the Strike Force. StrikeForceEnergy.com. Use your promo code CIGARNERDS for 20% off your order. Kick the can. Get your little 10 pouch that you can take wherever you go.
It's
or your
tactical.
750 bottle of, and now you can get all the flavors in the bottles as well.
Oh, so, is that, can you do that now?
Oh, yeah, I got me a 750 of the orange, just a little boom, boom.
Nice. Very
blatantly
nice.
Stealing that from Ross Patterson.
Yeah, blatant ripoff, actually. We'll be hearing from their lawyers. About the cigar, though, I mean, because this cigar did not just originate as the La Imperiosa. It was originally released as, what was it?
The Las Calaveras.
Yes.
Because Crown Heads does this annual kind of memorial cigar. It's different each year, called the Las Calaveras. And one of their previous blends was so well-liked that, you know, you can't find it anymore because it's one of those limited edition cigars, that they took that blend and put it into a regular production cigar, a.k.a. the La Imperiosa.
Yeah.
I mean, so I think it was like the 2014
blend. Yeah, 2014 blend. And they released that in, I want to say, three different Vitolas of 1,000 boxes apiece. So 3,000 boxes total of this cigar, and it sold so well. It was in such high demand that they did something they hadn't done yet before, which was turn it into a production cigar and create a new name for it and move on.
Yeah, so if you had that original cigar and you loved it, now you can have these. Or if you missed it, now you can have these.
Now you can have these.
Another thing, too, you know, this episode we're going to have our last of our Dragon Con interview series with legendary voice actor Steve Bloom. But when you hear that interview, we were doing it in a press conference setting, so you may hear some people asking questions that aren't us. So if you hear some voices you don't recognize, those are some of the other reporters that were in the room at a time. So not to confuse you.
You're going to be confused problem. Because...
We're easily confused as well, so don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. You're in good company.
And with that, we'll be right back. And welcome back to the podcast. It's time to get your bespoke suit on and your pimped out tactical umbrella, because it's time to talk about 2014's Kingsman.
Yep, and you don't want to be, you know, you never sacrifice for Fitting Room 3. Always take Fitting Room 1, because you're that important.
Exactly. Yes, Kingsman, the Secret Service, directed by Matthew Vaughn. It was based actually on a comic book miniseries by Dave Gibbons and Mark Millar, which, you know, it kind of came about because, you know, the spy genre had just gotten so super serious with stuff like, you know, Bourne Identity. And it's like every spy movie, even, you know, James Bond, when after, you know, for Daniel Craig took over, kind of had a serious turn, you know, but, you know, they wanted to kind of bring back that fun action spy genre from the 60s.
Yeah.
So
the over the top stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of like the 70s, 80s Bond stuff.
Yeah. Like the Roger Moore era.
Where
the Bond villains had ridiculous plots and giant underground bases with laser sharks and whatnot. With
metal teeth.
Yes.
Jaws.
Or in this case, metal legs.
Well, in this case, yes. Metal. Exactly.
Ah, oh, gosh, it's such a great film too. Because I love the fact that it didn't take itself so seriously. I think that's what made Kingsman so great. Is
oh, absolutely.
You know, it's so proper. You know, and you know, this is a great film that, you know, you're getting ready for homecoming or proms or weddings or whatever, and you need etiquette. Like, this is my go-to etiquette film.
Yeah, because this is kind of like, you know, one of those where they're taking, and you've seen it in other movies, they take someone from the streets or someone who's not a proper gentleman or a proper lady and teach them the rules of society, but while also making them a badass spy. And that was kind of cool, because, you know, Eggsy, he's like a English kid from the streets, and is like, you know, stealing cars and getting into all this, you know, English hood rat stuff.
Well, I mean, you see that, you know, not to get too serious here, because Kingsman has its serious moments, but I mean, yeah. You know, you go from, you know, having the nuclear family to, you know, something tragic happening, and then all of a sudden life spirals out of control, and you're just thrown to, you know, the wolves, and, you know, unfortunately, you know, the mom, you know, didn't have the best emotional response and, you know, goes off the deep end.
Yeah, because, you know, Eggie's father turns out was a Kingsman, and end up sacrificing himself to save his partner, Harry Hart, a.k.a. Galahad, because all the Kingsmen are based on the Knights of the Round Table, so all their code names are the famous knights, like the head guys, Arthur, and you got Lancelot, and the whole crew. Galahad like presents Eggsy's mom with this medal, and is like, if you ever need a favor, you know, I can't tell you how your husband died or anything like that, but he was a hero, and if you ever need anything, call this number.
And as every secret agent, the family doesn't know what they were doing in the first place, but yes, your husband died someplace that we can't tell you, and doing something that we can't tell you, but thank you.
Yeah, and yeah, they're, you know, that was another thing too that was unique about the Kingsmen, is they weren't, where James Bond is MI6, you know, worked for the British government. This was a private intelligence agency. They were, you know, kind of a spies for the good of the country, the good of the world, because it's like basically after World War II, a lot of these super rich families lost their heirs and kind of invested in this secret group to try to prevent future wars from ever coming about. And, you know, it's kind of been like, you know, it was based on the, you know, gentlemen of society, but, you know, they're kind of like, you know, we've kind of gotten stale. You know, let's, you know, because each Kingsman, when there's an opening, each of them sponsors a candidate. So, like, you know, he decides that we need to kind of mix things up and get some new blood in here. And so his candidate is, of course, Eggsy, the son of the man who saved his life.
And talk about the training. Like, you know, that shit's legit. Like, you know, it's, you know,
I mean, it's completely bring it over home, the top.
Well,
but
I mean, you know, like, just imagine, like, you sign up for something and you have to sign off on your own body bag. Yes. Like, it doesn't get any more real than that. Like, you know, if you fail, this is what you're leaving in. Like,
yeah, and the thing is, like, yeah, because it's like, oh yeah, that first training scene, they all show up and they're like, you know, first thing you got to do, fill out your paperwork, sign your body bag. So, you know, because if you fail out of training, this is pretty much where you're going to end up or whatever. And they're like, ah, this is just scare tactics. They do this in the military all the time. And then all of a sudden, they flood their bunks and drown a guy.
Yep.
They're like, well, oh shit, it's not intimidation tactics.
You know, but I mean, you know, that's kind of a revolutionary, you know, kind of plot there where you know, see everybody, you know, you've got the main group that's like, oh, yeah, we don't know what the fuck to do, so we're not going to do enough, you know, anything. You know, Eggsy, you know, kind of takes, you know, the, you know, logical approach, and it's like, ah, that looks like a two-way mirror. I can probably break that, but, you know, in the process, rather than everybody banding together, which would have allowed everybody to survive, you know,
it's everyone herself and all the other recruits kind of revert back to, because they've all got some kind of military background or some kind of education. You know, they know that there's air in a toilet and you can use that to breathe, but they're all, you know, snatching the shower pipes and making snorkels, but they're not escaping. They're just surviving, where he thinks outside the box and looks for a way out instead of, you know, just a way to kind of wait it out, which was kind of
until somebody comes and gets you. But yeah. Nobody's coming to get you.
But like, to back it up a little bit, you know, before we get into the training, let's talk about the introduction of Harry Hart, played by Colin Firth.
Yeah.
Which this is also a new role for, because he's not used to portraying a badass. He's always like in these romantic comedies or this historical epics where he's like always, you know, a gentleman, and he, you know, you see him, you know, suited up and think he's a gentleman, and then he like fucks everybody up.
Well, you know, I mean, this would be one of the things that I could see would absolutely put a tactical umbrella on the map.
Yes, I still
you know, when I hear about unbreakable umbrellas, this is the film that, you know, I have flashbacks to, and I'm like, I could do that.
I keep trying to win one of those at a steampunk convention. I'm finally going to have to buy one because I want one so bad after watching this movie. But yeah, Eggsy, you know, he had actually joined the Royal Marines, but then dropped out of training because his mom's living with this abusive douchebag, and he's afraid to leave her alone with his stepfather, so he drops out of training and kind of just becomes a kid in the hood stealing cars and getting into shit, and has kind of pissed off the local gang. And he finally gets arrested for stealing a car, and, you know, has to break down and use his get-out-of-jail-free card, and, you know, Harry picks him up and takes him to the pub to...
But I gotta say, if you steal a car, and you drive that well, tell me there isn't somebody that's like, nah, they're coming with us. Like, yeah, you're basically being put on, you know, the top-tier race team there is, you know.
But yeah, I love it, because the whole scene's kind of like a pre-interview for actually putting him through the training, because he takes him to the one bar where he pretty much knows they're going to get into shit, because this is like the gang's bar, and they show up, start threatening him, and he's like, you know, get the fuck out of here, and he's like, I think I'm going to finish my Guinness. You never uninterrupt a man's Guinness. That's like rule number one there. No wonder they got their asses beat. But he's like, no, I'm going to sit here and finish my pint, and they're like, you know, say a bunch of other stuff to him, so he's like, you know, all right, and they're like, yeah, get out of here, you wanker, go home and like, you know, blow somebody or something like that. And he just like stops and like starts locking them in with him, and he's like, manners maketh the man. And then smashes a beer in the guy's face and proceeds to beat the shit out of everybody.
Yeah, that's what I would like to call an attention getter.
And then finishes his Guinness. Yes. I mean, of course.
Of course.
Because that's...
Why wouldn't you?
Exactly. It's alcohol abuse otherwise, and that's not gentlemanly.
No drink left behind, gentlemen.
Yeah, but then he, like, you know, plants a bug on Eggsy, so when he goes home and his, you know, stepdad beats the hell out of him and is like, you know, yeah, who are you with? And, you know, just to see if he's going to give him up, and he takes the beating, and, you know, he's like, all right, well, this kid, you know, he's rough around the edges, but he's got the heart and the potential to be a Kingsman. Like, I can work with this.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot to say about life experience versus being taught from a textbook. And that's what I always, you know, kind of took away from this film is, you know, you don't learn things out of a book, you learn by doing. And, you know, I think that was the thing that really separated Eggsy's character from, you know, so many of the other recruits and, you know, the backstory, and, you know, it I don't know, like, in a way, like, this film for me was always kind of Casino Royale meets, you know, coming of age meets, you know, so many different portrayals from films that I liked. I mean, it just...
And I love their James Bond-esque technology, too, because he takes them to the, you know, the Kingsman's official... you know, business cover is their tailors and suit makers.
Of course it is.
You know, kind of like James Bond always had the whatever Universal Imports was his cover. So, you know, not only takes him in, shows him like the suits and all that. It's like, you know, not only is everything like super pimped out, but everything's weaponized. So he's got like a badass lighter, which I want. That's actually a grenade.
Do you want the lighter or the grenade?
Both. Yeah, like a high-end, I think it was like a DuPont lighter that's actually a grenade, and then, you know, sweet, you know, like leather shoes with a built-in poison knife and the freaking tactical umbrella, which is still the cool
and
thing.
You can't forget the glasses. The glasses. Like,
the glasses were something.
Okay, because there was several sequences in the movie, you know, speaking of like the cinematography of the movie, there's several, like, badass action sequences where they, because the glasses have cameras in them, so you're seeing it from like the camera's perspective, but it's very video game-esque, where it's like that first person shooter. Yeah, especially later on when Eggsy's like in the bad guy's base, you know, shooting and stuff, and you've seen everything from his perspective. Yeah, it was very much video game.
Well, you know, and you know, speaking of the cinematography, like there was a lot of, you know, examples where you see either a body part or blood splatter or something, you know, and it flashes to that first person. Like, it almost to me it was like that would have been great in a 3D shot.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm surprised that there were, you know, and maybe that was the intention at some point, because some of that felt very like, oh yeah, that should be popping out of the screen and, you know, coming at you. Like, I think that most of the time 3D movies aren't that immersive, but I think this film, you know, might have benefited a little bit, you know, from some of that, you know, just to keep with some of the overtop antics.
Oh, and
maybe I disagree. I think that might have been more over the top than, because we're already there, especially with some of these fight scenes. I mean, not to jump too far ahead, but the bar scene, great. Church scene was incredible. But the bad guy underground base, the mountain base scene.
The mountain nightclub, over the pretty top. Much.
Over the top. And if we tried to tack on 3D with some of that, that might have been way more than people could have taken.
But before we get in
into
the highlights, let's talk about our villain for this. Because you can't have a badass, you know, spy movie without an equally badass spy. So yep, we have
our man.
Villain. You have Samuel L. Jackson as Valentine and Sophia Boutelis as Gazelle, which, you know, is his you know, his jaws, but she has prosthetic legs that have swords in them.
Yeah.
Oh,
totally see that.
Yeah, and the whole the funny thing is, like, he's so weird, because he's, you know, we've talked about Elon Musk, like, possibly being a Bond villain. You know, he's pretty much a Elon Musk type guy, where he's like this super tech billionaire who is giving out free internet access and free cell phones to people. And everybody thinks he's like this super duper philanthropist.
Yeah, when did people realize that nothing in life is free? Like, you know, when somebody
it's offers, a trap.
Yes, you know, it's, hey, here's this free thing that's going to spy on every aspect of your life.
You know,
and you're going to carry it around in your pocket, and it's going to link to your social networks.
Stop angering the Facebook gods. Okay, don't anger the Facebook gods.
Everyone has a cell phone these days, and he's also kind of a weird environmentalist, because his plan is the Earth can't sustain at the rate of growth that we have. So he's going to take out like 2/3 of the population. So this cell phone car that will emit a signal that turns everybody into raving homicidal lunatics, except for the people he's implanted with, you know, chips to protect them, and also to, you know, hide his select people that he thinks will be needed in the post-apocalyptic world, whether they want to join his crew or not.
I mean, the motivation isn't necessarily unique. There are several movies where, you know, the villain's motivation is the Earth needs our help, so we're going to kill off 2/3 of the population. How he did it, though, is the trick.
That's the always makes the best bad guys is the bad guys that don't see themselves as bad guys.
Absolutely. Because it's more natural that way. I mean, nobody really thinks that they're the bad guy.
Yeah,
I'm trying to save the world.
Yeah,
why are you stopping me?
But yeah, that opening sequence, where, because that's the other thing that's so weird about his villain, is you think villains are these tough guys, but he's phobic of blood and has like
violence in general.
Yeah, he doesn't want to see violence or blood. In fact, his first thing, which ends up getting the opening that Eggsy auditions for, is to go capture this scientist that needs to complete his plan. And, you know, he's like hiding out in this cabin being protected by a Kingsman. And, you know, his henchwoman Gazelle comes in there and offs everybody. But then she has to like cover all the bodies up before he comes in to give his Bond villain speech of why the professor should join his team, because he'll puke if he sees any blood. And of course, you know, the professor is played by Professor Arnold, played by Mark Hamill, which is kind of a joke, because in the original comic book, that character was named Professor Mark Hamill. So they changed the name.
I did not know that one.
Mark Hamill to actually play the professor.
Did not know that one.
And then they have the cool, you know, anyone who agrees to join his team just so he can ensure loyalty gets implanted with a explosive device that when explodes makes like rainbow-esque colors and makes a pretty good fireworks display.
Yay
when you set them off.
For floaty powers.
Oh.
Yeah, that was, you know, that's kind of crazy, you know, too. Like, I think about, you know, when the cabin gets raided and you see the guy, you know, literally dude is cut in half, but there's no blood or anything. Like, some of the most gory, what should have been, like, the most gory sequences had no blood or anything whatsoever. Like, that's what I loved about this film, not taking itself so seriously.
Yeah, because when the heads explode, they should have been brain matter everywhere, but it was just like this weird puff of rainbows, you know, purple and pink and blues.
Where do I go to get those fireworks?
Yeah, the head splody fireworks. Oh, but yeah, so while Eggsy is going through his training, Harry's trying to figure out Valentine's plan and hunt all this stuff down.
Oh, God. And probably one of my favorite scenes of the movie is when Hart goes to sneak into what's supposed to be, you know, this major fundraiser party. It turns out it's just him and Valentine. They sit down to have dinner with McDonald's and super expensive wine. Which I can totally see, but
yeah, because in typical spy fashion, he's like, "Oh well, he's having this fundraiser. Let's buy and make a big donation and buy a ticket." But you know, of course, you know, Valentine's on to him, and so he pretty much cancels the party. So it's just him. He's like, "Oh shit, I can't blend in. I gotta, you know." And they had that cool, like, you know, conversation too, discussing classic Bond movies. They're like,
"Oh yeah, they literally spell it out for you because." Valentine's like, "I want to be the good guy," and Hart is like, "No, I'm more into the villain."
Yes, yeah, it's because, I mean, yeah, the movie itself is like I wouldn't call it a spoof, but definitely an homage to the classic spy movies. So it's
absolutely
it's so, like, you know, freaking whatever, talking into the third wall, the fourth wall. Them, like, you know, discussing James Bond and all.
I mean, everything except for directly talking to the audience they're doing.
And I heard, like, that's one of the reasons why Samuel L. Jackson took this role was, like, he's like, "I've always wanted to be a Bond villain, but this is probably the closest I can get."
I loved, you know, his character. The whole lisp aspect, though, kind of, oh, yeah. You know.
It was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, it was, but I was like, it was really hard because it's like, I see Samuel L. Jackson, but it's not the Samuel L. Jackson that I'm used to seeing. And, you know, it did a mind fuck.
No, he's not the lost guy. He's not the hardcore badass.
I mean, did he even say motherfucker?
I think he did at the very end of the movie when he's telling...
Kill that motherfucker! Exactly. But yeah, it wouldn't look like, you know, the traditional...
But not... Yeah, there was no motherfucker, there's no nothing.
Yeah, like, I mean, it was... You know, that to me was just a crazy, you know... It's playing mind games with me.
No, he held to that Elon Musk-esque role.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
So well.
But then, you know, to talk about... You know, your favorite scene, and probably my favorite scene too, is Harry finds he has some kind of connection to this basically Westboro Baptist Church style, like, you know, hate filled church group, and goes there to, you know, investigate it. But turns out it's just a test for his weapon to see if it actually works. And so he just turns the whole congregation against each other. But Harry's in there too, so he's just as nuts as everybody else. And, you know, Eggsy's watching this through, like, the camera, you know, feed from his glasses. And it's just, like, you know, the most badass fight scene. Like I said, very video game-esque with that first person of him just, like, fucking up people right and left.
Yeah. You know, that to me, I was like, you know, this is one of those times where, you know, we could adapt some of that Hollywood magic and maybe just go ahead and wipe out Westboro.
But then he stumbles.
I could see this being a very fitting end.
Yes. But, you know, since Harry's the only one there that's like, you know, with any kind of training, he actually survives and stumbles outside where Valentine's waiting for him. And he's like, yeah, I suppose this is the spot in the movie where I capture you and tell you my entire plan and you escape in some equally ridiculous way. And he's like, yeah, I kind of like that. And he's like, problem is, this isn't that type of movie. And just shoots him right in the face. So I was like, oh, shit.
And then he throws up.
Yes. Because
he just shot the guy in the
face.
It's
the first time he's like, you know, ever had to, you know, do the violence on his own. And Gazelle's like, oh my God, you actually shot somebody. How's it, does it feel? Does it feel good that you finally like manned up? And he's like, no, it feels awful. I can't believe I just shot that guy in the face.
Why do you do this?
Oh. But yeah. But to back up to Eggsy's story up until this point, I mean,
because at this time the training montages are going on as they're slowly dropping like person after person through the training. Did we talk about the trainer?
Oh no, freaking Merlin, yeah. Who played by Mark Strong, who he's like their Q, their like tech guy who runs the missions and you know. Builds all the technology and is just like a badass, but he's like, you know, badass in his own right, but he like has like a lot of cool moments. Like they all do, they're doing a halo, like one of the final tests, like, all right, we're going to do a halo shoot, and if you open your chute above 3,000 or, you know, 300, I forget what it was, like some like ridiculously low out, you fail. If I detect you on the radars, you fail. If you go splat, you fail. If you fail to like land in this like 6-foot circle, you fail. Oh, and and after they all jump out, you know, that, oh, just to make it more interesting, one of your chutes don't work. And, like, all the other guys panic, but, you know, Eggsy's the one that actually tries to save his fellow agent.
Who actually literally comes up with a plan on the fly. Thank you very much.
Is that a fly or is that a fall? I mean, you know.
If you've ever done it, it feels like you're flying. So there you go. That's something.
I believe I can fly.
If I just flap my arms really fast.
And you feel like you're soaring.
But then I love it. It has that moment, like, when after he lands, he's like, you know. Because Eggsy's like, you know.
Oh, it gets all up in his face.
Yeah, because he thinks, like, you know, everybody's picking on him because he's, like, the non-rich kid in the group. And he's like, can't believe you sick bastards did that shit. And then he's like, and he finally gets like right up in Eggsy's face and then pulls his cord and his parachute opens up because he just never tried to shoot. He just assumed since everybody else's shoot worked that it was going
to
be him.
He said something like, if you have something to say to me, you come say it to my face. And click, vroom.
And he's like, you'll be a good agent if you can knock that chip off your shoulder. And of course, you know, they all have like in, you know, you've seen this in other movies or other training things. They're given a pet they have to take care of throughout their training. And, you know, most people get, like, you know, actual, like, you know, German shepherds and bull, you know, big dogs. And Eggsy ends up with a pug.
It's okay. It'll get bigger, right?
No.
No, it won't.
And the final test is you've got to shoot your dog that you've raised.
Yeah. You predictably, know, I mean.
You know, that for me, that I would have failed that aspect. It's like, you know, I would have valued the dog probably much more than most people's lives. So it's like, I think I probably would have took Eggsy's approach and been like, you know what? Fuck you.
I'm more disappointed that they didn't see it coming.
Yeah. And, you know, so he fails and, you know, tries to steal, of course, and get revenge and steal a car like he normally does. But, you know, Harry brings him in. He's like, I can't believe you threw away all this training over a fucking dog. And he's like, you've killed a dog to join this, you sick fuck. And he's like, he has like the dog stuffed in his office. And he's like, no, jackass. He's like, it was loaded with blanks. You know, that dog died of old age. You know, if you had went through your training, you would have known that.
Yeah. And obviously at this point, when that happens, it's down to two people.
Yeah.
Eggsy and what was her?
Roxy. Roxy. Played by Sophia Cuddison.
Yes, and she was, after he was thrown out, he quit because he failed, she became the new Lancelot.
Yeah. But then after Harry's death, the Kingsmen have a tradition of doing a shot of some very old brandy. And yeah, Eggsy goes back to the Kingsmen's suit place and Arthur invites him in, who played by Michael Caine, who's a badass actor in his own right. You know, and but then of course,
yeah, he is.
You know, he offers her to let Eggsy do a shot for Harry, and he notices the telltale scar, and he's like, oh no, he's gone over to the dark side.
Well, I think I think even before he sees it, he realizes it and says, you know, since when do you break your own rules?
Yeah.
Like, that's never been a thing before. And then, you know, but the sleight of hand I thought was awesome.
Like, yeah, because he's like, hey, what's that? Is that, painting, original Kingsman? And he's like, looks away. And then he's, they all drink and he pulls out the little, it's kind of like a detonator pin to activate the poison. And, he's like, hey, this, I talked to Valentine and Valentine, actually has a good point. So here's your chance to join us. He's like, you can even take Harry's spot, but you gotta, play ball. And he's like, yeah, go fuck yourself. And he ends up,
killing himself.
Yeah, so at that point, they don't know who's on the take, so it's up to Eggsy, Merlin, and Lancelot to foil Valentine's plan.
And, just the trio. Like, the dynamic works so well.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, then they go to his hideout while she tries to take out like his satellites and stuff, and Eggsy gets to suit up finally because he's like, Harry had this suit made for you, so he finally gets to do it. And that's the thing too, when he's going through Valentine's epic base, which is just like any good Bond villain with their base. Not only has he been talking people into joining him, anyone who thinks the world needs, he takes them. Whether they want to go or not. So Eggsy finds a Swedish princess.
Of course he does.
And is trying to break her out. He's like, if I get you out of the cell, can I have a kiss? And she's like, oh, hell yeah. And then, he finds out that he's like, you got to stop Valentine. He's like, I got to go save the world. She's like, well, if you can save the world, we can do it in the butt. Which is like the best. He's like, well, I'll be right back. Talk about motivation.
Well, and I mean, there was actually a lot of backlash, because of that scene, where, a lot of groups were like, oh, you sexist, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, I think this is, one of those times where the film doesn't take itself so seriously.
Yeah, like, I mean, in the tradition of 60s spy movies, you got to have the lead guy getting some. That's just Bond always ends up saving the world and having sex with some girl at the end, and that's just
of course he does
the way it's got to go. But I love the fact that they can't hack into the system to shut down the weapon because it's basically like bio locked. So as long as Sam's hands on the button, it's going to happen. So he comes up with the idea can you hack the detonators? And so they set off all the traitors' bombs, and then there's this epic sequence of them playing what is it, the 1812 Overture or something, and people's heads exploding all over the world. Even because pretty much all governments or whatever had been in on this plan, so
they blew up the president and the entire cabinet and bunch of generals and all of the guards
and then
pretty much everybody except for Valentine. And his henchwoman.
Yeah. Oh, but then that epic fight scene with him and her, where she's got the sword legs and he just has the knife in his boot, and they're like a whole fight going on. And then, of course, Samuel Jackson getting impaled with her prosthetic leg. And it's so funny, too, because he not only gets stabbed, he looks down and sees the blood and pukes because he sees blood before he dies. And then, of course, Eggsy goes and is able to, get his prize for for saving the world.
Yes, the prize he was promised.
Yeah, and then shows up back at the bar, all suited up, and to offer his mom a way out. And he's like, I've got a new job. It also comes to the house, so y'all can come live with me. And they're like, get the fuck out of here. And he's like, all right. Turns around, locks the door, and it's like, manners maketh the man. Now he is Harry.
Yeah, essentially taking the role that was complete reprise of the role from his first encounter way back at the beginning of the movie.
Yep. And then that brings us to the recent sequel, 2007, Kingsman: The Golden Circle.
And we're going to Poppy Land.
2017, not 2007.
Anybody got any burgers?
2017. Oh, yeah.
That's not so recent. The sequel, which came out before the original. This is not Star Wars.
Yeah, this kind of jumps a year into the future where, you know, Eggsy has been...
Wait, do we have to say spoiler alerts maybe from here on out?
Yeah, it's still in theater, so at this point, yeah, spoiler alerts. Yeah, we're going to spoil the shit out of this.
That's kind of the point of... Otherwise, this would be a very short podcast at this point.
Yeah, it was like, you know, made for $104 million. The first movie was made for $94 million, made $414 million. This one's $104 million, and it's still in the box office, currently at $218 million, so... It looks like it is a success so far. Also directed by Matthew Vaughn. You know, this one, we have a new villain who is equally cool, played by Julianne Moore. Poppy Adams, who is basically all the drug cartels.
She's not Mary Poppins, y'all.
She is the head of all drug trade in the world and lives in this... She's so obsessed with, like, American culture from the 50s. She's built this little 50s town square in the middle of, I don't know, where was it, Cambodia or Bolivia?
Yeah,
it was
like Cambodia.
Some, like, you know, middle of some ancient temple out in the jungle where she runs, you know, all the drug trade, but she misses America and has built this little America.
I mean, on the surface, before you find out the inner workings, I'm like, this needs to be a place I need to go. But, you know, once you find out the inner workings, you want to stay far away.
But in cool Bond villainess, she's got robot dogs and a robot tattoo artist.
I mean, she's really? Even got, you know, her own, you know, personal entertainer, you know, Elton John.
Which was just hilarious because, like, yeah, she has Elton John, like, you know, captured as her personal musician slave because she's like, well, you know, Valentine was kidnapping all these celebrities, so I figured, hell, I might as well kidnap one, too. Nobody will notice one more gone missing.
A nice little throwback to the original movie.
But also throwback to the original movie, like, the opening, before we even, you know, meet Poppy and whatnot, Eggsy is coming out of the Kingsman tailor shop and gets approached by someone who he thought he had killed, Charlie, which was one of the original Kingsman candidates that he was competing against who failed out and end up joining Valentine's crew. Somehow he survived the head explodey things because Eggsy had tasered him. Apparently that shorted out his chip, so it just blew his arm off and instead of, like, blowing his brain off. And now he's got a sweet robot arm and is working for Poppy.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, to stick with the car, you know, chase themes and everything else, like... Man, some of the driving sequence in this, I think, put Fast and the Furious to shame.
Oh, yeah, because it's like the most epic fight scene within a car chase. And when he finally, like, takes over the car and, like, flips the switches and goes from being a, you know, sedate English taxi to, like, a hot rod, he just does some, like, serious hardcore drifting and launching missiles and everything else. I mean, it's like the most badass of Bond cars. Oh, and then he has to swim through the sewer. His night literally went to shit.
Yeah, it's like, is this dinner really worth it? And it's like, well, yes, it is.
Yeah, because as we have revealed, after his rendezvous with the princess, he end up dating her. So he's in a relationship with the princess.
Well, I mean, you know, that's proper gentleman etiquette. You know,
yes.
He wasn't a hit it and quit it kind of guy. You know, he's there for the long run. You know, he is the true gentleman.
Yeah. But Poppy apparently is aware of the Kingsman, and, you know, the whole, like, attempt on Exe's life was just a plot to be able to break into their computer so she can learn all of the secrets of the Kingsman, and decides to take them out with a mass missile launch. So the store's blown up, everyone's house, even the Kingsman's mansion's blown up, and pretty much everyone is eliminated, even Roxy. Like, the only people still alive are Eggsy and Merlin, because Merlin happened to have the night off, and Eggsy was having dinner with the king, meeting his girlfriend's parents for the first time. but then they killed his dog.
Yeah, I was going to say, didn't they then blow up his house and kill his friend?
Yeah, his
and
friend
his
who was
dog-sitting,
so...
I mean...
If nothing else is going to generate some revenge, it's,
have they not seen John Wick at this point? I mean, don't they know how this goes? You kill somebody's dog, and it's on at that point.
But I, you know, that to me, you know, I thought that, you know, was a fun sequence. You know, they're sitting down, and, you know, the dinner's going all proper, and, you know, Eggsy's basically relying on Roxy to feed him, you know, intel and everything else. And, you know, it's like the parents are just like, holy shit, where did this guy come
from?
He's like,
oh, yeah, what do you think of this, like, economic thing? And he's like, oh, yeah, because she's, like, just feeding him, like, all this stuff. And then, like, in the middle of it, her father's about to eat something, and he's like, you know, his buddy finds his glasses and ends up breaking into the conversation. He starts playing with, like, the lighter grenade, and he's like, put that down. And the guy's like, what? He's like, put that right down. And he's like, the king's like, what's wrong with my my king? but yeah, after everything gets blown up, apparently there is a doomsday scenario. They're like, if anything bad happens, we need to go to this winery and open this, you know, secret vault that will tell us, you know, what to do next. And they open it up and they just find a bottle of bourbon. And they're like, well, don't know what this means, but we should have a drink for our fallen comrades. And it's Statesman whiskey. So they do a shot. And they're like, well, we should also do a shot for this other person. We should do a shot for England.
Yeah, basically now we're just drinking.
What about we should do a shot for the dog? It's like, and they end up like drinking the whole bottle, and like Merlin's crying, and they're all drunk as shit. And then he noticed that, you know, it says made in Kentucky, and
yep.
K is a Kingsman's K. So they're like,
we gotta go to Kentucky.
Here's a clue. We gotta go to Kentucky. So they visit the Statesman's Distillery.
Well, should we do one more? Nah, I think we've had enough.
But yeah, they go to Kentucky and to the Statesman Distillery and find out that America has its own private spy group, much like the Kingsmen, but they're the Statesmen. Instead of the Kingsmen's, you know, cover and funding is high-end suits, theirs are, in typical American fashion, whiskey makers.
Of course they are.
And everyone dresses like a cowboy, and instead of all their code names being, you know, famous knights, their code names are types of alcohol. So you're introduced to Agent Tequila and whiskey. Agent Whiskey, and their version of Merlin, played by Halle Berry, as Ginger Ale. And I love, you know, Jeff Bridges showing up as the head of the American statesman known as Champagne. Call him Champ. And I love in his office, there's a framed photo of Jack Daniels on the wall, too. Just a little shout out to a American bourbon and whiskey.
Yeah, you know, for me, that was a highlight, you know. And, you know, I kind of liked, you know, this film is interesting because, you know, I mean, like we talked about earlier, there was some backlash from the previous film. And this film did the complete opposite dynamic where, you know, it's like, yeah, we're going to get Channing Tatum, which, you know, is a lot of females' heartthrob. You know, deck him out as a cowboy, and, you know, I mean, you know, I remember all the, you know, once it flashes to Channing Tatum and, you know, does his intro bit, you know, everybody swoons, and, you know, then it's like...
Because Channing Tatum.
Now we're going to put him in cryostasis, so, you know, you had your moment, and, you know, now it's gone.
That was the whole tease of the film, because Channing Tatum was in all the trailers. You're like, oh my god, he's going to be, like, the star of this movie. No, he's in it for like 20, 30 minutes and then is gone until like the very end of the movie.
You know, not to sidetrack, but there was a movie a while back called Executive Decision.
Yes, with
Steven Seagal. And Steven Seagal is like billed as the star of this movie in every promotional piece that they did for it. And they kill him off in like 20 minutes into the movie.
Yes.
And he's completely gone.
Turns out it was Kurt Russell movie.
It was a Kurt Russell movie, but... That's what that reminds me of.
So you get Channing Tatum's like first fight scene when Eggsy and Merlin come to break in and figure out what's going on, and then find this whole intelligence organization, but also find a friend from the past they thought was dead, because he's like, you know, we don't know who you are, but we found this English guy who killed a bunch of people, and Like,
maybe it belongs to you.
Yeah. And it, you know, of course, Colin Firth, Harry, has survived because the statesmen have developed some kind of nanotechnology for treating head wounds. If any of their people are injured in the field, they all keep this thing that basically gels around your head, and little nanobots, you know, rebuild your brain. But then they have to, there's like a trigger that will reboot their brain, but since they don't know who Harry is, they have no idea what his trigger would be. So he's kind of reverted to a younger self where he thinks he's a guy who studies butterflies.
Yeah, he's
stuff.
Like an entomologist, and yeah, he's like, you know,
that's what he would have done if he hadn't joined the military. And apparently, like, you know, of course, since that whole church thing was on American soil, the Kingsmen showed up, or the statesmen showed up to investigate and find him and revive him, but they don't know what to do with him.
Yeah, other than he's the last person that was living at the end of that when they found him.
And yeah, of course, Poppy's big grand plan in all this is, since she controls all the drug trade and she wants to be able to return home to America, she poisons all the, you know, introduces some kind of virus to all the recreational drugs. So anyone who has taken drugs now develops this, like, blue veiny rash.
The blue vein thingy.
That eventually turns you, stage one is the rash. Stage two is, like, mania, which you also get a sequence of, you know, Channing Tatum in his cowboy hat and, you know, hospital gown dancing in the hallway.
Of course you do, because you can't have Channing Tatum in the movie and not have him dance. I think
and
it's in the contract.
Stage three is paralysis and then death. And her thing is, like, you know, unless the President of the United States agrees to pardon her entire organization and legalize all drugs, she's going to let everyone die. But the President is like,
okay.
Yeah, fuck them. Like, you know, let them all die. Because if you wipe out all drug users, I've won the war on drugs. Because if there's no one to buy your drugs, you know, the drug trade's going to go away.
So not, he's exactly, just gonna, like, not the most well thought out plan.
Yeah, so he's just like going to pretend
he's... Let's kill all of your users.
So he's going to pretend he's like on board with this and let everybody die. So it's up to what's left of the Kingsmen and the Statesmen to save the world. And unfortunately, Agent Tequila apparently likes to burn a joint now and then, so he's infected and they have to freeze him. So yeah, you get Channing Tatum for 20 minutes and then you never see him again.
Kaput.
Until the end.
At least they didn't kill him off.
Oh, Agent Tequila. So yeah, Eggsy gets his new partner, Agent Whiskey, who has a badass laser whip.
Yes. Very Indiana Jones-esque.
Yes.
Like. And Agent Whiskey is played by?
Pedro Pascal.
All right.
And in fact, I don't think they ever call him by his name. They call him Agent Whiskey, but his name was actually Jack Daniels in the movie.
Of course it is.
And oh,
which is odd because, on a side note, that didn't Old Forester sponsor them for the movie by and create like their Statesman whiskey branded for them?
I'd like to get Jack Daniels. Yeah, I'd like to get a bottle. And they had an autographed photo of Jack Daniels in the office. I'd like to get a hold of some of that Statesman whiskey.
It's on the list.
Pretty cool.
It's on the list.
But yeah, I love too Merlin, you know, typical, you know, Englishman. He's like your whiskey's shit, you know, doesn't stand up to a single malt scotch.
Yeah, some of the pandering back and forth there was awesome.
Yeah, before they realize, because, you know, they don't know who they are, and, you know, Agent Tequila's threatening to, you know, pour his whiskey in their laps and is threatening to set their balls on fire until Ginger Ale comes in and was like, no, they're like, I opened our Doomsday Vault too, and there's an umbrella in it that says Kingsman. So, like, you know, these guys are, you know, on the level.
We don't know how yet, but, you know, I thought it was, you know, kind of talking back to, you know, Harry's progression and trying to get him back into, you know, the Kingsman state of, you know, frame where, you know, they're like, hey, you know, it takes the memory trigger, like you were talking about. And
it has to be some kind of great trauma from their life. So
you see, you know, Eggsy, you know, go to a pet store and brings in a dog that looks like the puppy version of
Peppers. They try to drown him like they did in the training, thinking that will trigger him, and it doesn't. He just almost drowns. So he finally comes up with the idea of the dog and comes in and, like, threatens to shoot the dog, and it reboots Harry, but he's not 100%. So I love it. They go to like an American bar full of cowboys, and they come in and you know, a fight. You know, the guys start threatening him, so he's like, "I'm gonna do my famous kick everybody's ass," and goes to the door and locks it, and like, you know, the you know, manners maketh the man, and goes to throw the beer glass, and just completely misses the guy because now he has, you know, he got shot in the face, so he is, they repaired his brain, but he's still missing an eye, so his depth perception and aim is a little off.
Hey, as a person that's been one-eyed at one point in time, it's a real thing.
And he keeps going, like, he tries to, like, hit somebody with the stun watch, too, and misses. It's like a constant thing of him, just, like, everything's just a little bit to the right of where it used to be, and him having to recalibrate himself. But since, you know, he fails and starts to get his ass kicked, you know, Whiskey has to step up and beat the shit out of everybody in the bar while Exy and the rest of them are, like, having a drink, and, like, and there's this whole, like, badass fight scene going on around him where they're just, like, you know, sipping beer and, talking about the state, catching him up on the state of affairs.
I don't, you know, I thought the other thing was, you know, the least likely badass character turned into a complete badass, and I gotta give a shout out to Elton John on this, because, dude, he made the feather suit fucking like his fight sequence was like, oh. You know, it's like, damn, yeah. You know, maybe he needs to be a new recruit.
Yeah, because the whole like,
isn't
every time you see Elton John, it's like they're like, hey, Elton, we need the thing. He's like, fuck you. It's like does not want to be there, and it's hysterical. But you know, they finally kind of trace things back to Poppy's hideout, and you know, freaking Merlin finally suits up, and they all go in there to take her out, and yeah. Elton John finally has enough of being everybody's bitch and, like, just beats the shit out of two guys while wearing a very colorful feather suit, which yes. Made it even in traditional Elton John big-ass sunglasses, and it just made it even more hysterical, and ends up saving Harry because the dogs are programmed not to eat Elton John, so he stands in front of Harry and blocks the dogs.
You know, I thought it was cool because the freaking robotic dogs are named Benny and Jet, so, I mean, you know.
Everything is genre specific.
But I don't know. Probably, you know, I think for me, one of the most iconic scenes, I think, is the industrial, you know, meat mixer that, you know.
Oh, yes. Because, like, when you first meet Poppy, she looks to be this sweet lady. And, you know, they're bringing in a new recruit for her gang. And she goes in this whole thing and it's like, you know. The guy who recruited her, he goes, oh, yeah, this is my best friend, Angel. He's like, well, Angel, you know, your buddy here fucked up. So if you want to join our crew, put him in the meat grinder. He's like, what? And then, like, you know, he picks dude up, throws him in the meat grinder. And he's like, all right, you know, you're in. You know, go to the salon and get, you know, your hair done and whatnot. And, goes in there and there's this, like, robotic salon lady who files his teeth down so he can't be identified with dental records, burns off his fingerprints, and then gives him, like, this molten gold tattoo of the golden circle. And then he comes back just all, like, been through shit. And she's cooked him a nice hamburger out of what his buddy was shredded into. And he's like, just one more thing. Here, take a bite. I mean, that's like, dude, been through some shit right there.
Oh, yeah. It was funny. Like, I, you know, flashing back, like, you know, and in fact there was a girl that had to leave the theater, you know, because, you know, like her initial reaction when the body goes into the mixer and then it flashes to the, you know, big hunk of ground meat, like, sets her gag reflex, but once the guy probably takes a bite of the burger, she was gone.
That's too much. Just too much.
And then, you know, like I said, Harry's back, but he's not 100%. He ends up shooting Agent Whiskey in the head because they go to find the antidote and get one sample, and he accidentally breaks it. And Harry's like, no, he's a traitor. But they all think Harry's just gone nuts because he's, you know, kind of having weird, his brain hasn't fully healed yet. But sure enough, Whiskey, you know, they're able to take out Poppy and get the password to release the antidote to everybody. But, you know, Whiskey shows up and it turns out that his wife and and Child were killed in a drug robbery. Like, you know, somebody high on drugs came in and robbed a store and ended up killing them. So he actually wants all the, you know, drug dealers and drug users to die off. So he's not working for Poppy, but he, you know, wants the president's idea to,
yep,
to go through. So then you get this epic, like, three-way fight of them, you know, Harry,
yeah,
and Exe finally being able to team up together, because they never got that in the first movie.
Yeah, they were never able to. They were always separated.
Yeah, so them getting to be agents together and fighting Whiskey in, like, the most epic fight scene.
Yep, and then there we go right back to, was the meat grinder.
But before that...
Oh, let's I'm talk jumping about, ahead. Let me not jump
No, no.
Ahead.
Like, it's a, yeah, that's the conclusion of that fight. But let's talk about, you know, Merlin's story arc.
Yeah, Merlin, you know, he becomes very much the you know, the forefront. Like, you know, and that's the thing. Like, you always kind of see him as, you know, cure or whatever, where it's, he doesn't really get involved, yeah, in too much of the action. But here, you know, he's absolutely thrown into the mix and, you know.
No, it's his time to step up and, yep, suit up.
And, you know, he really takes on, you know, a role of his own. And it's super sweet to see him, you know. And obviously it probably should have been a giveaway from the first film because, oh, yeah, he's in charge of training. So, obviously, if he's in charge of training, he's well-versed and, you know, yeah, a badass.
They have a whole conversation, yeah, obviously, with him and Ginger Ale talking in... And she's like, have you never wanted, because he's like, you know, he's always been the guy behind the computer telling everyone else what to do. He's like, have you never wanted to go into the field yourself? And he's like, no, not really. And she's like, well, I've always wanted to be an agent. But, you know, every time there's an opening, you know, I get voted down by, you know, Whiskey or whatever. And, you know, he's like, well, yeah, I've never really, you know, thought about it. You know, but then, like, once it's like he has to step up, he suits up and gets the umbrella and everything else. And, you know, Exe does that thing from the first movie. She's like, you know, looking good, Merlin. He's like, feeling good, Exe. So, just like he did back when he first got his suit.
Yeah, back when at the airplane scene in the first
and
movie.
At some point he mentioned that, like, you know, he did like the American West. He's like, I love John Denver.
So, yeah, Country Roads, you know, absolutely plays a big role, yeah, in this film.
So as they're sneaking into her base, Exe steps on a landmine and, you know, Merlin's, yeah, able to disarm it temporarily and then steps on it himself.
Yeah,
to,
no,
like,
he basically files him a line of bullshit so he can get him out of there.
He's like, oh, this will freeze it and we can disarm it. So he does it and then pushes Exe off and takes it. And he's like, no, you're here because your father took a grenade for us back in the day. So this is me repaying that. And he's like, you know, I'm, you know, and then he basically sends them off on the mission and then cuts down, you know, exposes himself to all of the guards by singing Country Road. And just has this, you know, epic moment of him, you know, singing John Denver while all the guards come in to, like, you know, figure out what the hell's going on. And this kind of gives Harry and Exe a wink and then steps off the landmine and clears the path for them to take on the objective. I mean, he went out like a boss.
Yeah.
Yep, and the music and everything like that building up right there as he's singing. And then backing out when they actually show the explosion.
Yeah. And then, after, like, the most American of weapons, you know, they, you know, take the, borrow the American's plane to go take her out. So they're going through their weapon stocks and there's baseball grenades and, and like, whatever, a baseball bat minesweeper and just all these, like, you know, while the English stuff is all, yeah, instead, you know, very of, English, you know, the,
yeah, instead, yeah, of the very classic English gentlemanly accessories.
Yeah, it's all, this, like, is completely cowboy different stuff. Yeah, it's like very, very American.
Where do I get a baseball hand grenade?
Yeah. Oh, and that final fight scene while before they, you know, have to fight Whiskey, when Harry's fighting the dogs and Exe is finally, you know, going after robot arm Charlie, that too is, like I said, this movie not only had the badass action sequences from the first, they definitely expanded on them and made, like, even bigger action sequences. I mean, it definitely, like, you know, met the original and surpassed it as far as, like, the action sequences go.
Well, and I mean, in a way too, like, the character dynamics, I think, you know, really even intensified in this. Like,
it was cool seeing Exe, like, you know, in the first one, this is his first mission. Well, this one, he's been on the job for a year. So seeing him, as a qualified agent in his own right, it was pretty badass. You know, seeing him like, you know, not being the new guy, being, you know, he's the new Harry pretty much until, you know, they find the old Harry.
Yeah. And then we have two Harrys.
Yep.
Well, yeah, and that because becomes
that comes later.
Well, I mean, that becomes the running gag of, you know,
Says Galahad, and they're both like, yes, the new Galahad.
It's like, all right, you guys need to do something because, you know, this two Galahad thing is very fucking confusing.
And then so after they save the day and save the princess once again because she had also been infected because she smoked some weed. You know, they go back to the Statesman, and the Statesman, you know, like, well, this two Galahad thing's confusing. Why don't one of y'all be our new Agent Whiskey? And they're like, and Halle Berry's like, well, I'd actually like to be the new Whiskey. And, you know, she finally gets her wish to be an agent. But then they're like, well, you know, we decided to buy a Scotch distillery over in England. So, you know, now we're not just cousins, we're, you know, we're brothers now.
Yeah,
so
one family.
Yeah, so the Kingsmen and Statesmen are together. You know, we bought this distillery, and we're going to put y'all back in business. And, you know, of course, you see the Kingsmen tailor's shop rebuilt, and a car pulls up, and you think it's going to be X, and it gets out, and it's freaking Channing Tatum is now all dressed like an English gentleman, which was,
yeah,
he looked
exactly
really weird in a suit.
But he made it back in the movie, so that's not bad.
Yeah. But the one thing that kind of disappointed me with that ending is I thought it was the perfect opportunity to when they showed the rebuilt Kingsman, they should have had a conference room sequence and had Harry be the new Arthur. I mean, that's probably logical progression because they've already said this is probably going to be a trilogy of movies. Since he is the, you know, highest ranking surviving Kingsman, you would think he would become Arthur at the end of the movie. But like I said, that's they're probably saving that for the next film, but like that's something I wanted to see at the end, like a cut sequence of him at the head of the table.
I think you will get that. I don't think this is the end of Kingsman at all, and I think that we probably do see that in a third film.
No, the way that these two movies have gone so far, I would totally see them carrying on. I mean, you know what? They've made a trilogy out of worse movies.
Yes.
I mean, can we say ass blasters in this podcast?
Always. Yeah, and
I mean, that was like a series of five movies, though. I mean, but I mean, you know, and I think that Kingsman, in its own right, like, you know, both of these films, I think, are very much on equal playing fields. You know, it wasn't a, hey, the first film was successful, so let's just, you know, copy over. Like, this holds, you know, the same feel and everything else that, you know, the first film brought to me. So, I mean, you know, this is one of those rare times when I would say, hell yeah, give me a third film.
And the cool thing is the Kingsman's Tailor Shop is actually filmed in a real location. I think it's the Huntsman Tailor Shop. And, you know, if you go there now, you can go on Google Earth and go to, like, Street View and look at their front glass. But they've put a little Kingsman K in, like, the bottom corner of their sign. It's kind like, of a
nice little cool homage.
Little yes, shout out to
the very subtle, yeah, if you understand what this symbol means, you know where you are.
Yeah, come in and get your exploding lighters. So as we
do you get a sweet discount on a, you know, a
bulletproof
custom suit?
Yeah. So as we wrap this up,
well, you need to make sure you ask for the right fitting room.
Yeah, you gotta get the right fitting room. So, final thoughts. You have a particular character moment sequence from these two movies that you know, your favorite. What about you, Brad?
For me, I think it was the dynamic between Roxy and Eggy. Or Eggsy. Eggy. Let go my ego. You know, just the way that, you know, they made such a dynamic team. And it was, you know, not only from we're statesmen, we're partners, but also from the whole, you know, just we're actually friends. And that almost kind of goes against, you know, some of the training and everything, you know, with emotional attachment and everything of that nature.
Yeah, because, you know, there was only one of them supposed to make it out, but then they both got together. But you see a lot of that in, like, you know, regular, you know, law enforcement, military training. The people that you go through your training with become some of your best friends. And they had that sequence when she's feeding him information to impress his girlfriend's parents, where he's like, you know, Roxy, you're the best. And she's like, best agent or best friend? And he's like, both. So what about you, Norm?
All right. Yeah, I mean, out of all the characters in between both movies, I think I'm really with Merlin on this one. I mean, he's from when he's just their trainer, and his attitude and the little and the quips and the situations, even all the way down to his final scene when he's there and he convinces Eggsy to, you know, get off that landmine. He takes his place and then uses that to pretty much clear the field for them so they can carry on the mission. I mean, everything about the dude is perfect.
Yeah, and he has some of the best, like, little one-liners and comebacks of, like, of the movie. He had, like, some of the best lines. I mean, he was a badass.
I mean, he's the most British of them all.
And, you know, for me, it's like, I love both these movies. As far as the new group, Agent Whiskey was a badass. Like, I love the whole sequence when they're surrounded by henchmen in the little ski of chateau. He goes out and just, like, fucks everybody up. Yeah, dual wielding the old six shooters, spinning them around and, like, whipping out his, like, you know, laser whip and going all Indiana Jones. I mean, it was a badass sequence. And of course, the if you save the world, we can do it in the butt. And they even bring that joke back for this movie. My favorite lines.
Well, I mean, you know, but they made it kind of subtle, you know, and they gave it to Elton John of all people, which I really loved, you know, where it's, you know, save the world and I'll give you a backstage pass.
Oh, and we didn't even talk about, like, the wedding at the end where, you know, Eggsy marries the princess and Elton John's, like, playing the wedding. Yes. He's like the next movie, he needs to be like a Kingsman himself. That would be hilarious.
I mean, I think he's definitely earned, you know, honorary, you know, Kingsman status. I mean, you know.
At least we know where he's going to buy his suits from.
I mean, he's already knighted. He is Sir Elton John. True. So.
I mean, it solves that whole dilemma.
But what, the only actual knight in the Kingsman?
Exactly. So with that, we'll wrap this up and be right back.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountain, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountain, blowing like a breeze. Country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home, country road. Country road. Virginia, mountain mama, take me home, country road.
Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30. And welcome back to the podcast. It's time for some beer. So, you know, we've talked about the English and American collaboration of the Statesman and the Kingsman. So now we're going to talk about German and American collaboration. What are we drinking this week, Brad?
So this week we've got Sierra Nevada's Oktoberfest. And, you know, this is the 2017 Fest beer. So they've actually partnered with Brauhaus Mittenberger. Our Milton Burger, which is one of, you know, Germany's most highly regarded craft brewers. So, you know, this is, I mean, you know, Sierra Nevada as a home brewer and everything was what put craft beer on the map for me. You know, a lot of people think that, oh, they're such a big company, how can they, you know, be craft? But they are very much craft. And
yeah, It's not so much the size of the company, yep. but it's how the process is done.
And, you know, this is just absolutely phenomenal. You know, so this is going to, you know, sport your lager yeast with German Magnum, bittering hops with German Select, Tittenberger and, Spalter finishing hops with Two Row Pill, Steffi Pilsner and Munich malts. I mean, this is, you talk about, you know, beer, this is as true to beer as you get. Like,
yeah, this is a very German Oktoberfest festival beer, which is yeah. one thing I always want to go to the Germany Oktoberfest. And I can't believe right here in Georgia, I've never been to the Hellen Oktoberfest. But yeah. that's, you know, but yeah, that's something I love about
Germantown, Georgia.
Love about Sierra Nevada's website is they give you so much information on the beer. So if you wanted to brew it yourself, I mean, it's even got what your beginning gravity and ending gravity should be. You know, the doesn't give you a recipe, but it gives you the contents, so you could actually, you know, maybe Frankenstein up a recipe for this, since you know what's going into the beer. And then they also give you pairings, you know, and of course, since this is a German-esque festival beer, they say it pairs well with, you know, German sausage and roast pork and, you know, beer cheese and, of course, Aperol Strudel.
Yeah, and I mean, this is, I mean, it pours beautifully. I mean, you know, it
just watching it such a clarity,
and you know, just I mean,
the delicate lacing across the head. Oh, sorry, is that not golden? What you guys say?
Golden talk? amber color.
No, I mean, it absolutely has a great lace to it. I mean, you know, it's got a, you know, rich head. I mean, it's exactly what you would expect from Oktoberfest. And I mean, you know, Oktoberfest, you see a lot of, you know, styles, but I mean, this is...
Yeah, especially right now, being so close to Oktoberfest, everyone's got it's like every domestic brewery almost has their own take on a Fest-style beer.
You're going to find two things, Oktoberfest beers and pumpkin beers.
Oh, God.
And pumpkin please, spice everything.
Please stab me in the eye, both of them.
There's some good pumpkin beers.
There are no good pumpkin beers.
The Warlock is disgusting, but there's a few pumpkin ales that aren't bad.
Yeah, not the sidetrack, but you know, the pumpkin ales, if the pumpkin is very subtle on the finish, I'm fine with it. But the ones that are just all pumpkin all the time... Oh, no, like, thank you.
The Warlock is the great, like, lost beer review because it was so bad that we didn't actually air that review because it just tasted like straight-up pumpkin spice. Like, somebody had poured cinnamon and, like, pumpkin pie flavoring into your beer. It was disgusting.
So, you know, folks, you know, I highly encourage you to look for the 2017 Sierra Nevada Oktoberfest.
Yes.
You know, this is a one-time only, you know, fall seasonal. So, you know, once this, you know,
one brewing
batch is done, then, you know, it's kind of done. But, I mean...
If you want something similar, you're going to have to go to Germany.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is... It's a five. It's a solid five. From color to taste to everything... That doesn't happen often on the podcast.
I'm very happy with what I'm experiencing here right now. I'm willing to go with the expert here and call it a five as well.
Yeah, I just really want some sausage and a polka band right now.
I mean,
yeah.
You break out the Lederhosen.
Hey, we don't have that far to drive, and we can have, you know, authentic European cuisine. I mean, yeah, you know, we can get our spatzel, we can get
there's literally a really good German restaurant right here in Cumming. It's not far from here.
And they've got Das Boot there.
Ooh, Das Boot.
Yeah.
All right, so with that, we'll be right back.
And now it's time for Blowing Smoke.
We'll talk about their lives and talk about how they're impacted by this work that we've done in a bubble for so many years. And the wonderful thing I found about DragonCon is that despite its massive size, I still have those opportunities to have those kinds of conversations, talk about real world stuff. And the staff here seems to be of that same mindset. It really, you can tell that it's run by people who love this and who are really here for the fans. And I appreciate that. I really enjoy that aspect of it.
Yeah. Is when you're coming up with a voice for a character, do you already have a voice in mind, or is it once you see what you're going to look like on the screen, is that when the voice starts to develop?
Yeah, I try never to pre-anticipate something based on knowing that I'm going to be playing a character. I do like to see either a model sheet for the character, or I wait for the actual description of the character, however they end up describing it, whether it's on paper or by the director. That actually helps me to paint a picture in my mind, and quite often that changes when I get into the room to actually record it. So the preconceived stuff sometimes happens automatically, but for me, I'm a much more visual type person, and I kind of go back to the sandbox days where I'd be sitting with a little action figure, giving it a voice and having them talk to each other, and that's kind of the way I run my career. It's a very organic process. Yeah, that's a great question.
With Zeb, there's obviously was a you know, they've done a diversity of accents across the Star Wars world. So when they come along for Zeb, like how much instruction did you have there as far as what he was going to sound like?
We actually did a lot of it by committee. My first impression, getting the description of the character, and I think my first audition was more taught Cockney type accent and a little bit less intelligible. Once I made it, I think, to third callbacks, and I went over to the studio and sat in front of Dave Filoni and the whole crew, he started firing things at me. He said, all right, now try Russian, now try German, now try Northern England, now a little bit of Australian. And I think what we ended up with was just a bad UK accent, frankly, that wasn't quite, you can't quite place where it's from, and you might hear a little bit of Australian slipping in sometimes. We just wanted something that sort of sounded familiar, but could potentially be off-world and that would fit nicely in with all the other dialects that were happening. But there was a lot of pressure on Zeb in the beginning because he's new to the Star Wars universe based on a Ralph McQuarrie design for the original Wookiees. And I tried to push all that out of my head because that freaks me out if I think in those terms. And it didn't really even dawn on me until I started recording Zeb for real once I booked the job. The weight of all of that and how deep it would go. And in fact, I had forgotten that it was a Star Wars thing. Because in the beginning, I didn't even know it was Star Wars. The original auditions, the original first few auditions, he had a completely different name. The show was under a code name. Everything was top secret. And so I kind of pushed that in my mind. And when I went to the third callbacks for it at the studio, it didn't even occur to me that this was going to be a new Star Wars series. They may have even said it at the time, but when it really clicked in, I was in Birmingham, England, doing a Transformers convention when I got the call that I'd booked it, and they needed to record that day. And they found me a studio in somebody's house in some suburb somewhere. They dropped me off with a taxi, and I'm walking around this weird neighborhood, and this lovely English couple comes out of their house, and they look like Ma and Pa Kettle coming out of this house. And lead me inside, and I go upstairs, and they put the script in front of me, and I see stormtroopers on the script, and I went, this is Star Wars. This is really Star Wars. And I might have squeed out loud with everybody on the phone on the other end at Lucasfilm, and that was the moment that it really clicked in for me that this was Star Wars, and this is something that's going to become part of the Star Wars universe permanently. And I'd worked on the games for years, but this was a whole other level. And that was when we really refined the voice and the dialect for the character. And no pressure doing a UK accent in front of native speakers. So, but I think that kind of helped it along, just speaking to this lovely couple who had invited me into their home and hearing their accents kind of helped me dial in, too.
My wife's Australian. The Australian does come through at times.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She picks up on it. She's like, hey.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite accents, and I do it really badly, but I love sprinkling it in wherever I can.
Speaking of video games, I mean, you do a lot of animated stuff, but also, like, you know, what is it, Guinness World Record of prolific video games. Yeah. Is there a different skill set to recording, you know, a non-linear video game type audio versus, you know, a linear complete story, you know, an animated series or movie and such?
Well, it's the acting is acting. It's really the same principle. The biggest differentiation is in video games, we have to do it a lot faster and a lot more of it. games like Mass Effect, for example, I walked into the studio and they gave me like a 4-inch stack of paper and said, this is what we need to get through today. And it's, you know, like 1,000 to 2,000 lines done in 10 different ways. So you have to be able to put just as much quality into each one of those lines as you would if you were doing 40 lines on a 4-hour session on an original animated production. That's really the challenge, is just the stamina and being able to stay present for 1,000 lines or more. And in that case, we rely on our director very heavily, and the director will give us all the context we need. There's no time to really go over the context of the grand arc in the video games. And it's much more taxing physically, especially when we're doing a lot of fight scenes or what we call sound sets, the impacts and the reactions, that sort of thing, which can be very grueling. And at the end of one of those sessions, I literally feel like I've been through that battle. I can feel it in every fiber of every muscle in my body.
And personally getting shot 150 different ways.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ways to die, and I have died most of them repeatedly, and that's just something I happen to be pretty good at. I'm probably better at dying than anything else.
As a player, so am I.
yeah, but it's kept me employed for many years, but it's grueling. It's really, really tough on the body. Yeah, do you have a question?
Yeah. So Spike Spiegel is where I first became really aware of who you were. Cowboy Bebop's my favorite anime of all time.
Oh,
do you feel like that's easier or harder because you've already got a source material that you're pulling from and you're doing the American version of it? Mm-hmm. Or do you like doing something original more than an anime?
Ooh, boy. That's a very complicated question.
Sorry.
Anna, no, it's good. I like the complicated ones. I began my career in anime, and so that's actually what I'm most comfortable doing, even though there's the technicality of the juggling act of looking at the script, watching the screen, listening to the director, staying in character, and trying to not only match what's there before, but to try to enhance it and make it palatable for an American audience. It's a very interesting balancing act that not that many people are really good at, who are fine actors. It's a tough skill set to do. But literally, that's where I began, and that is my comfort zone. And I love the people involved in anime. And it's less lucrative than anything else I do. I'm probably making the same thing on Naruto that I made 20 years ago. But I do it because I love to do that. That said, it's kind of a solitary experience. I'm in the room by myself, across the glass from maybe one or two other people, and that's it. I do love being in an environment where it's a full cast, like Transformers or Wolverine or Rebels, where we do get to play off of each other and we become a family. And that's a lasting thing too. So with anime, it took me probably 10 years before I met the entire cast of Cowboy Bebop. We were never in the room at the same time. And so we have to come to conventions or events that we're doing, premiere type things, before we'll meet each other. And occasionally we'll see each other in the hallway and give each other a high five, and we know of each other. But literally, it took me, I think, 10 years before I met most of the people on that cast.
Wow.
And on something like Rebels, or there's a show that we're working on now called, or we finished just recently, called Transformers Rescue Bots. Not only is it fun working with these guys, but they become family to the point where we still text each other from wherever we are in the world and check up on each other. There was a fire in my hometown over the weekend, and people who are all over the world at conventions now are checking in with me to make sure that my house is okay. I mean, that's something that you can't really experience when you're working in a solo environment. And the camaraderie of all of that is the most important, most fun factor for me. Not to mention the fact that in a cast-type situation, we get to play off of each other, and they're hilarious people. They're some of the funniest people I've ever met in my life, and many of them are stand-up comics and improv actors, and I learn so much from them, and they improve my performance, and hopefully stuff that I do will give them ideas to play with, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last time you and I saw each other was at Celebration.
Yeah.
That's when the announcement came down about the final season of Rebels. Now you've had some time to digest. I know.
Thanks for bringing that up, dude.
Sorry. Now you've had a little time to digest it. So, yeah. Like, where's your head at now with it?
Well, it's so many emotions, and it hasn't gotten easier, honestly. I love this franchise so much, and I loved this incarnation of Star Wars so much that it's very bittersweet for me. It almost causes physical pain to know that it's over, and I will stop thinking about it for a while, and then we The trailer was just released today for season 4, and it brought up all the emotion all over again, knowing that as soon as this starts airing, that's kind of the beginning of the end for Star Wars Rebels. So yeah, I'm a sad puppy today. I'm having a hard time with it. That said, Dave Filoni and everybody at Lucasfilm put so much love into this stuff, and being a fan of Star Wars since 1977, knowing that they get to do it the way they want to do it, they get to finish this the way they want to finish it, unlike with Clone Wars, where they really couldn't bring it to its natural conclusion, that gives me solace, and I want this to have the ending that it deserves, and I'm not going to tell you what that is. But
would be a good idea.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't be a good idea at all. I can feel the chip already starting to blink.
I have lots of Zeb appearing in a live action possibility, and you could still voice him, but I realize that you probably can't answer any of that yet anyway, considering there's still a season to go.
Yeah, from your mouth to their ears, please hire me. Please hire me. Please hire me. Cartoon live action, I don't care what it is, just let me do the voice. I hope that it continues on. I certainly see a setup for it now that Zeb and Kallus are a thing.
Romance.
Yeah, right? You know, I just want to go off to Lirisan and start a family. That's all. there's so many things that we can do from this point forward, and I just hope they include me in it. I hope I haven't upset anybody enough to the point where they won't hire me again. But I hope it continues for a long, long time to come. They tend to do that in the Star Wars universe. They tend to bring people back. In different forms, one form or another. And they know that I can die really well as a stormtrooper, so even if Zeb doesn't work out, I'm still willing to give him a live Wilhelm scream. So, yeah.
All right, I believe we have time for, like, one more question.
Okay.
I have one.
Okay.
I've heard you do so many voices for so very many things. Has there ever been a part that has stumped you where you get a script and you're just like, I don't know how to play a 12-headed dwarf from outer space who wants to kill the world with kittens? I don't know what this part is.
That sounds easy. The one that I think was so odd, and at first I thought I wasn't going to be able to do anything with it, but it was an entire landscape made out of human feces for a thing called Kashmir the Flying Camel. It was an audiobook narrated by Brian Cranston, and it was just myself and Colleen O'Shaughnessy, a great voice actor. And we did all of the parts. Colleen and I did. She did all the... I think actually we cross-gendered too on some of them. But one of the characters in this was literally an entire landscape made out of all the ills of humankind, all of the fear and the doubt and the detritus waste from humankind. And it was a very friendly creature, but he would just sort of... His mouth would just sort of bubble up out of the ground at one point and then come up from another place, and he smelled really bad and... It was really disgusting. So I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with that. But once I got in the room, something clicked. It always does. It's again, that 8-year-old in the sandbox. And it ended up just being a kind of thing. It started there, and then a voice sort of emerged from that. And it just pops. That's my disease. It sort of happens. So the stump, fortunately, doesn't last for too long. The only time that it's really difficult for me, if it's a dialect that I'm not familiar with, and then I'll just have to be honest about it and say, I know somebody who can do this better than I can. Or just, if they want the crappy dialect, I'll give it to them. So that's happened before, too. The funny thing about that is that I actually took a dialect class recently to try to get better at the authentic dialects. And I came in for a session, and they wanted me to do some Irish character, and I started doing an authentic dialect, and they said, no, we want something that's more stereotypical, and it ended up being a Lucky Charms dude again. So you know, no matter how much you prepare, you don't know what you're in for, and so the stump thing isn't really too much of a problem, because generally they'll know what they're getting when they hire me.
I guess you wouldn't be working as much as you are if you could be stumped that easily.
I guess, I'm kind of fearless that way too. Even if I'm uncomfortable with something, I'm going to try it out. And that's what I recommend to all the voice actors coming into the business, is that do the thing that scares you the most, and do that as much as you possibly can. And that's the joy of this, is the discovery of that and getting through that fear and to the other side of it. And when you do, you come up with something unique. And that served me really well throughout my career.
ESO, 7 years of keeping it really geeky.
Hey! What are you trying to do? You ruined my record, man! I just bought it!
Hey, you guys!
How exciting! Spoilers!
It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes, it's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
Bye-bye, boys.
Have fun storming the castle.
Think it'll work?
It would take a miracle.
Bye-bye.
The Earth Station One Podcast. It's time to let your inner geek out to play. You can find them at www.earthstationone.com or up on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Peace, and we're done.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome back to the podcast.
Yay! Way to go, Norm. I like the proactiveness.
Joe is busy. I mean.
See, in the new segment, he's the one that says,
oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know that.
It's okay.
I forgot. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Did I just steal the thunder?
Newbie mistake.
I've only been coming on guest appearing for a couple of years.
Typically, by the time we roll around to this segment, though, you're long gone.
Also true.
You know.
Was that a clue?
I don't know. How many more hair jokes you got up your sleeve?
Like 5 or 6, honestly.
So, what's in the news this week, Brian?
Well, this week, we're going to talk about some movies. We're going to talk about some video games. We're going to talk about some, you know, marketing attempts that I don't think quite went the way they were anticipating. So, with no further ado, open it up and, let's talk about Pacific Rim 2. So we got a new trailer, and I'm not quite sure how I feel about it looking at the trailer. I mean, I kind of feel like if Tupac and Power Rangers somehow meshed, this is what we would get.
Yeah, I mean, they do have some sweet Tupac references.
Yes, so. So the soundtrack, for the trailer was a highlight. I don't know that it quite had the same feel as the first film, though, just in the little snippet. The action, seems to, be a little bit different, and I don't know. I mean, I'm not to say that I'm not going to see it, because obviously I will, and I'm sure that just like the first Pacific Rim film, that once it makes its theatrical debut, that it'll be on every, Starz, HBO, and that'll be the new show at the cigar shop.
Of course it will. I mean, what kind of question is that?
The Jaegers move, like the first one, they moved very slowly. They had like weight to them, and now they're doing like kung fu and flying kicks. Well, it is kind of Power Rangers-esque, as you said. That end, I mean, it's not...
Go Megazord!
We got a different director. It's not Guillermo del Toro.
A great director, by the way.
Yeah. The main guy from the original doesn't return. He's not in it. So we got like a whole new generation of Jaeger pilots. It's like the only people from the original is the two scientist guys. That's the only people you see in the trailer anyway. And then you have... freaking Boyega, who was like my least favorite guy of Star Wars.
No, he's one of the best characters in that movie.
You only like it for cosplay purposes. Yeah,
what's
he's
your
like,
point? I need more cosplay.
He was the wussiest stormtrooper ever.
No, my initial reaction from watching the trailer, which I just watched 30 seconds ago, I fully agree with the Tupac meets Power Rangers. And I don't know, overtones of Independence Day 2.
Yeah, where it's like
where
the kids now.
We kind of try to revive a franchise that's gone away, and we fail miserably at it because we're focusing on everything that didn't make the movie what it was.
Yeah,
focusing on the Jaegers and the monsters, but that wasn't the story.
Yeah, and I, you know, and who knows? I mean, you know, here you get just a few minutes. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to form a, you know, hypothesis of, you know, or, you know, speculate. And but I don't know. I mean, you know, and maybe for me, you know, Del Toro holds, you know, a kind of special place for me, you know, so I don't know. I don't necessarily want to bash it without first, you know, giving it a full, you know.
Yeah, and like whatever the general or whatever from the first one, I guess Boyega is playing his son.
Yeah, that's what it looks
so
like.
So it's
back to Independence Day 2.
Yeah,
I'm just saying. I haven't seen the movie. All I have is the
yeah. Bit I don't know how watched, but how that's far my first feeling. Forward in the future this is from the timeline of the first movie, but because you know the two scientist guys look about the same, so it can't be that far advanced in the future.
They just don't age.
Yeah,
modern medicine is perfect and it's keeping everybody young nowadays.
But yeah,
except for you know the general and everybody else.
But like I said, it's the first one was so good that yeah, this one, like I said, with Del Toro not having him not having any kind of connection with this movie, it's, you know, I think that's a loss because, like, he's a good writer and director and, you know, he made that movie badass. So, yeah, it's never a good thing when, like, the sequel has nothing to do with the originators. Yeah. It's, you know, when has a tendency to fall off some.
When the original the surviving actors don't come back, the leads at least, when the original director doesn't come on board for the sequel, or is it tied even at all to the sequel?
Supposedly Mako has returned, but she's not even in the trailer, so I don't know how big of a part she's going to have.
We'll see.
I didn't see her in a Jaeger anywhere in that trailer, so.
I mean, I don't know. I almost wonder if, you know, we get the second film, and then, you know, Del Toro decides to take in the reins and say, yeah, we're going to pretend that didn't happen. Like, we see that happen a lot with Hollywood magic, but, you know, I just...
And there's sequences of Jaegers fighting Jaegers, so I'm like, I have no idea what the story of this movie is going to be. So, yeah, I think we're going to need more information before a final judgment on this
absolutely.
One. But yeah, they just didn't have the same, like, weight that they did in the original.
Yeah, I mean, it just, I don't know, I kind of, you know, view it as Call of Duty. It's like, oh, we went from World War II to modern times to now we've got jetpacks and we're playing Halo. Yeah, so
my backpack has jets.
Because you bounty hunt for Jabba the Hutt?
To finance my vet.
And there's a copyright infringement. Shenanigans.
You mean our first one?
Yeah, probably not.
All
right. We'll keep that to ourselves. And moving right along, up next for something that kind of has surprised me, that Justice League. Like, it's still weird to me to be like, hey, I'm actually looking forward to seeing Justice League.
Yeah.
Like, and I have to be cautious because so many times we see what looks to be a phenomenal trailer and...
Yeah, I hate to remind us, but that original Batman v Superman trailer looked badass as well, and that we were sorely disappointed. But, you know, they brought in Josh Whedon to do a whole bunch of reshoots and redos on this, so maybe he can pull it out of the crapper.
Yeah, I mean, where the movie has pretty much changed dramatically from where it was originally thought to be, and now we have this, and the trailer looks good.
Yeah.
I mean, as a diehard, you know, Marvel guy... Marvel Cinematic Universe person, where I'm a huge fan of just about everything they do. Seeing this, I want to see it also. And I'm, you know, especially after what they were able to do with Wonder Woman, I'm crossing my fingers, and I'm happy that Wonder Woman allowed, you know, all these extra bit players to be in her next sequel.
Yeah, and there's so much, like, comedy and lightheartedness that we haven't gotten from anything out of DC so far.
And I think that was part of where they took the whole reshoot towards, you know, to change the tone a little bit.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic, but then again, I think this is going to be released the same day as the next Avengers movie. So, this one will get seen later. It's not going to be opening night for me.
Yeah, I mean, and we see that oftentimes, you know, that can be detrimental to, you know, films when they're going up against, you know, some, you know, established franchises, and you know,
or maybe that's not the when this is coming out, because I think that was the thing I just saw a comparison. Like, if these came out the same day, which one you would go see? It would definitely be Avengers over this. But I mean, Thor Ragnarok's coming out pretty close to it. Now, like I said, if it's a competition between those two, I will probably see Thor Ragnarok first before I see Justice League.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I once again, you know, I mean, we'll have to see it before we can, you know, officially, you know, weigh in. But I mean, it's still just, like I said, a little bit odd to be like, huh, here's Justice League, and I'm curiously optimistic.
And while it would be a really bad idea for them to try to go up against a movie, a Marvel movie, because that'd be a box office doom, they could never get opening weekend numbers.
Yeah, right, apparently, because I think at one point Thor and Justice League was supposed to come out both the same day, but it looks like they've moved them around. Thor is now coming out November 2nd and Justice League November 17th.
Oh, okay, so there's a little bit of a gap. That'll do good.
And again, if it's like any other Marvel movies, Thor will probably still be in the theaters on the 17th.
Of course it will be.
It's like, how's this movie been in theaters for 3 months? Up next is, you know, Hulu is taking a stab in the Marvel Universe. And we've got our first, you know, kind of teaser for Marvel's Runaways. And, you know, kind of, you know, looks interesting. But, you know, once again, I'm you know, we've had this conversation, you know, when it comes to streaming services and everything of, you know, man, all of a sudden now I've got to subscribe to like 7 different streaming services because everybody keeps branching off and, you know, playing in the same universes. And
yeah, because like one thing I heard that the whatever new Star Trek series, because I've not seen it yet, but they did, you know, first episode on TV, the rest of it's on CBS's new streaming service, and it's supposedly like one of the most pirated shows ever because everyone's like, it's too much. We're like tired of having to buy 15 different subscription services. So it's like, people are like, eh, I want to see it, I'm just going to steal it.
No, and exactly right. I mean, you pretty much have a vastly popular series like Star Trek and their newest installment, and then you lock it behind the paywall of your paid streaming service that people generally aren't interested in signing up for.
Everyone's already got Prime, Netflix, or Hulu, or a combination of the three. Like, I mean, three, yeah. I can justify.
I have all three.
Eight,
but I'm not signing up. I'm sorry. As much as I want to continue checking out the new Star Trek series, I'm not going to sign up for a fourth streaming service.
Well, I mean, for that. For me, I go into it with a mindset of, you know, I need to know that it's worth me investing in. Now, obviously, we're not talking hundreds of dollars. I mean, but, you know, by the time, you know, a la carte, you know, services and picking and choosing, you know, once it becomes, hey, you know, every channel maybe has a $2-3, you know, streaming subscription, and I can say, hey, I only want these, you know, 17 channels. Or whatever the case is, it becomes more cost justifiable from that standpoint. But, you know, for right now, it's like, well, shit, I'm still having to pay cable on top of Netflix and everything because there's still not just one centralized place, no, you know.
Absolutely. And I mean, cable, I mean, the streaming services themselves, I mean, if you know, if it was $4 a month, but I think it's like more like $9.
I think it's like $8 now, and I think
and $4.
Netflix just announced another price increase.
Netflix is bumping up to $12 a month. I mean, these costs add up, especially if you're signing up for something just to watch one show.
Yeah.
Because everything else they have is regular network TV stuff.
Yeah, just 6 months to a year later.
Yeah, so you sign up for something, and you say you're going to keep it for 6 months, and you keep it for forever, basically, because no one ever really remembers to cancel these things.
And you know, I mean,
which is the plan. I'm sure that's the plan overall.
It's capitalism, you know, at its finest. But
I can choose not to watch your show
exactly
anymore.
You know, so I think for me, you know, we've seen Netflix come out with these, hey, you know, we're going to kind of do a test. So this season, you know, we're only going to do 4 or 5 episodes. You know, maybe give me a couple of episodes, you know, on the house to say, hey, this is quality content that I'm thoroughly enjoying, I'm much more willing to open up my wallet at that point versus, you know what, there's been some good Star Trek, but there's been some really horrible Star Trek, and oh my God.
The Trekkies are going to come find you.
It'll be okay. You know, beam me up, Scotty.
Really, that's the only thing I know of that's on that network right now. So it's like,
well, it is the only original content on the network.
Yeah, so it's like there's going to be more justify that.
You look at what you're getting for your cost of Netflix. You're not to get into a Netflix versus, you know, CBS All Access argument, but Netflix is got maybe 30 original content shows, like television shows, like a 10-episode series. And then on top of all the original content movies that they've been producing, I mean, you're getting a bigger value for your money.
The much better model is the CW's streaming service because they have the app where anything that's currently on TV, you get the last 5 episodes of it. But then they also have a subscription service, the CW Seed, with some original programming there. But if you just want to watch your main network shows, here's like 5 episodes at a time, or you can join the pay service and get the entire catalog.
And you know, from the stuff they give you for free, it's not really for free because you're making ad revenue off of it.
Yep.
But moving on.
So, you know, as we're talking about investing in everything else, you know, Avatar. God. You know.
Dances with Smurfs.
Are we talking about The Last Airbender or Blue Skin Smurfs?
We're talking Blue Skin Smurfs.
Oh, God. I go back to my original statement.
Oh, God. Well, you know, so James Cameron has begun filming Avatar 2, and we now know that there's, you know, going to be a total of, you know, 4 additional films.
Lovely.
So,
of course, he's filming in 8K, super duper high resolution.
Hey, you know what? I mean, you know, I got to say that, you know, watching the first Avatar, I mean, it was visually, you know, just, you know,
stunning. I can give it that.
You know, I mean,
stunning visually, but I watched it once. I mean, it didn't have any, like, deep replayability for me.
I watched it once under duress, and I can say faithfully that probably one of the most beautifully shot movies that I've seen, but that's about it. I know, controversial stance.
So I don't know. Hopefully, this $1 billion investment over the course of you know, these series of films, you know, will pay off. You know, I think with Avatar, I mean, I think there's a very distinctive line. You know, either folks loved it, or you know, they not so much.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really see too much middle of the ground, you know, opinions when it comes to Avatar. No. So,
and you know, it's an established series, and it'll
copyright infringement number 2.
Now for commercials. No.
It's really funny because the guy's got a L'Oreal hair care product playing that has no hair. Just to keep the theme of the hair jokes.
Thank you very much. I'm here already. Try the hummus.
We're going to switch gears a little bit. And, you know, Doctor Who fans, we have learned that Catherine Tate is going to be joining David Tennant for DuckTales. So I thought that was kind of cool. You know?
Have you watched any of it yet?
Some of it.
I haven't had a chance, but I'm really looking forward to getting a little time aside to catch up.
I've not had a chance to check it out yet.
So, I want to really like it, and I'm really I haven't heard anything bad about it yet, but I'm really hoping to enjoy it because I love the show growing up.
Yeah.
That's the thing, man. Like, how many companies now are just banking on nostalgia? Thanks, Nintendo.
Yeah, if you say Nintendo and all their, Super
Netflix,
NES
can
classic,
I say Stranger Things? Ready Player One?
I got to say that, you know, Stranger Things 2 is probably the thing I am most anticipating right now.
Especially get around to watching Stranger Things 1, then.
Oh, you do. It's so awesome. October 27th on Netflix.
It's kind of a thing at this
point. Or the Voltron Netflix series, too. It's like,
I think they're just... isn't that coming out with a new season?
Yeah, the new season starts, I think, the 13th. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that one as well. I've watched the rest of it. It's been pretty badass.
As I trash the news schedule with random good job. Conversations.
It's all right.
And now my last appearance on the podcast.
Going to switch gears a little bit to some video game stuff. One of the games that I am most anticipating right now is Star Wars Battlefront 2. And, I got to play around with the beta for a bit. And I got to say, it is freaking stunning. It's so awesome to get something with next-gen graphics.
And something with a campaign.
And it's got campaign and localized co-op. Because
I'm antisocial. I don't want to play online.
But you live in the boondocks, so you're going to have to learn to play online.
I can't play online. I live in the boondocks. I got to play a campaign mode.
But, a little bit limited. We didn't get to play any part of the campaign, just a little bit of a preview of some of the things that it's going to entail. But we did get to mess around with several of the multiplayer modes and, really cool to be able to battle out in space. There's even some, localized arcade modes where you're just set with, some objectives. And it looks like there's going to be a lot of content. Typically, I'm against pre-ordering. But this was the one game that I made an exception for. And, as far as graphics and everything else are concerned, just absolutely awesome. And then up next is Amazon The Tick is going to be returning in February of 2018. So, it looks like we will be getting, six new episodes.
Yeah, I still got to get around to watching that first series. So far, I've heard nothing but good things about it.
Oh, yeah, it's been pretty good. I've only seen a couple of episodes now, but... it's The Tick. It's what I wanted.
No, I can actually say this. I have actually the series I've actually watched, and it's great. I mean, I love the fact that it doesn't just focus on The Tick.
Uh huh.
That the whole series is really about Arthur, and his coming to terms with everything that's happening to him. I mean, it makes an incredible story and is a departure from the original, the source material in that way, but totally enjoyable. And I'm looking forward to when they actually release, the next series or the rest of the season, however they're planning on laying the whole thing out.
Yeah. And, as we, did our Steve Bloom Dragon Con episode just to kind of bring Dragon Con, back into the mix a little bit as we close out here. I would say probably one of the most popular costumes this year by far was Rick and Morty everything.
Oh, God.
Rick!
Yeah.
And, McDonald's tried to, play into the fans' hands of the show by bringing back its Szechuan McNugget sauce. But that led to quite a bunch of debacles. I heard stories of employees just not knowing what the hell it was or it just not being widely available. And, there was
people
quite a
bit. Bootlegging that shit on eBay.
Well, yeah, yeah, I mean, there was quite a bit of, outrage, and I think McDonald's, from a standpoint, it's like, oh shit, we really missed the mark here. There are a lot of upset people over it. Me personally... I got bigger, issues in life than, some McNugget sauce. I'm sure there's probably a clone recipe available online somewhere. But, one of those interesting things of, how sometimes a corporate entity can try to play into fans' hands and, ultimately it become a, bad PR experience.
Yeah, I think McDonald's corporate just underestimated the demand that the whole thing would generate. They just didn't see it coming.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know, spend some time at your local conventions.
Yeah, exactly.
And speaking of corporate tie-ins, Old Forester making a Statesman whiskey. Oh
yeah, we talked about that during the earlier segment.
Found it online, you get it for $50 a bottle.
Not currently available in Georgia.
Apparently not.
Shit. That's all right. There's online ordering resources.
Or road trips.
Any other news, tidbits, information that I missed that you guys want to weigh in on?
Speak about the final thoughts on this here cigar as we wrap it up?
This cigar is just wonderful. Oh my gosh. It started out, very peppery, but there was a complexity where you got some earthy notes and, some hints of leather and just, it wasn't just, all spice. Just phenomenal. I enjoyed the shit out of this cigar.
Started off with a pepper bomb, but then kind of, mellowed out into a better balance and complexity throughout, which was very good.
No, basically it shows that there was a reason why this cigar was the cigar that they decided to reissue. It's all there for it.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. It just... wonderful, wonderful smoking experience.
Yeah.
All right. And with that, check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. You can find us on CigarNerdPodcast.com. We're also on the ESO Network at ESOPodcast.com. If you need a cool real men smoke cigars, cigar nerd shirt, go to realmensmokecigars.com. Go to strikeforceenergy.com to get your energy drink needs. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Cigar Nerd Pod. And with that, remember, manners maketh man. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast with your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.